Good morning again. I told Jillian as I was coming to services this morning, I don't remember the last time that I taught the class and had a sermon afterwards. And, you know, Randy gets to experience that quite a bit as he's part of our regular teaching crew, too, and, of course, taking care of the speaking most of the time. But I'm very glad to have the opportunity to do that. There was some crossover in the thought, as I mentioned in the class. I actually decided on this topic a while back that I was going to do it the next time I got ready to preach. And then with the assignment that we had that fell to me for teaching this week, it ended up being some real similar thoughts along the way, or at least related in some ways. I've always found this story about the transfiguration of Jesus to be fascinating. It's something that I don't know that we all fully understand. I don't know that we can completely understand it. And the description that's giving, every time I read it, it's beautiful and I love to meditate on it, but it's also a little frustrating that there's no more detail. I'm just not sure that it could be explained in human words better than it is, and certainly we have been told what we need to know to understand. But I'd like to see if we can understand it a little bit deeper, a little bit better, and consider the meaning of the transfiguration as we look at it this morning. Please turn with me, if you will, to Luke chapter 9. Brother Brendan read the account in Matthew 17 for us this morning, and I asked him to do that so that we would have that comparison in our mind. But we're going to study primarily from Luke chapter 9 and read that account, where actually there are just a few other details that Luke included as he records his account of it in the gospel record. Luke chapter 9, verses 28 through 36. It reads, "And it came to pass about 8 days after these sayings that he took Peter and James and John and went up into the mountain to pray. And as he prayed, the fashion of his countenance was altered, and his raiment was white and glistering. And behold, there talked with him two men, which were Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spake of his decease, which he should accomplish at Jerusalem. But Peter and they that were with him were heavy with sleep. And when they were awake, they saw his glory and the two men that stood with him. And it came to pass, as they departed from him, Peter said unto Jesus, Master, it is good for us to be here. And let us make three tabernacles, one for thee, and one for Moses, and one for Elias," not knowing what he said. While he thus spake, there came a cloud and overshadowed them, and they feared as they entered into the cloud. And there came a voice out of the cloud saying, "This is my beloved Son, hear him." And when the voice was passed, Jesus was found alone. And they kept it close and told no man in those days any of those things which they had seen. So you'll probably recognize a few differences in the passage, just a few details here or there. A little different wording on a couple of things, but in essence, the same account in general. So the transfiguration. In the account here, that Jesus goes up into a high mountain to pray. He actually prayed just shortly before that. Verse 18, it says that he came to pass as he was alone praying, his disciples came to him. That was the question, who do people say that I am? You know, have that discussion. So Jesus is regularly seen praying throughout his ministry. I think the point is often made, and rightly so, that if Jesus needed to pray that often, we certainly need to be praying that often. And I promise you, I'm telling that to myself as much as anybody, that I need to be in prayer more often. I think the responsibilities of the eldership have really helped bring that to my mind as I think about praying for others even more specifically for the responsibilities that I have now. But everyone needs to pray more, and I certainly need to be in prayer more. And Jesus exemplified that throughout his life. He was constantly in communication with his Father for the ministry that he was going about. The mountain that they went to is unnamed at this point. In the account that we'll read near the end of the lesson from 2 Peter chapter 1, Peter refers to it as the Holy Mountain. Well, frankly, being on the mountain with Jesus and Moses and Elijah in a moment and the things that happened and what they saw, I guess any mountain that they would be on would be rightly called Holy Mountain. But it could imply that it was some particularly special mountain. Since it is described as a high mountain in another account, that it would seem like it was not Mount Gerizim or Mount Ebal or someplace like that in the central part of the land. It might have even been close to the city of Jerusalem, which was up on a hill, of course, and then maybe a higher peak. Some have suggested Mount Hermon, although that was pretty far away from where they were at the time. Others have even suggested Mount Sinai. And the reason I throw those out there is because if Jesus wanted to take his disciples away and walk a ways and end up on a high mountain and it be one of those distinct mountains, even physically very far away, it was easily done. That was nothing that Jesus couldn't accomplish. He's walked on water. He's going to be ascended into the clouds as after his resurrection. So getting them to a mountain that wasn't nearby very quickly and maybe without their understanding that they've traveled very far would not be a surprise to me. But it is not named, and it's just simply described here as a mountain, a high mountain, and Peter calls it a holy mountain later on. Jesus says his course, oftentimes, he took Peter and James and John. Sometimes we refer to that as the inner circle of the disciples. I don't believe at all that he was trying to separate them out. I think that they must have had a particular companionship. We talked this morning as we thought about the parables and looked at the previous account where they were vying for position, that James and John, the sons of Zebedee, well known to Peter and Andrew and Philip and others as we meet them when they're first chosen, were strong disciples among the group. They were outspoken. Jesus reminds us that they were referred to as the sons of thunder. Of course, we know Peter being as outspoken as he was and really the natural leader among the group, oftentimes speaking up first and speaking for the group, rightly so. And then later on, Jesus gives him specific directives on how he will contribute a lot to the cohesion of the group of apostles after Jesus is gone. So these three men in particular will take leadership roles. They will be a huge influence on the disciples, let alone all of the disciples around the world that we've made through their teaching. Their writers, John and Peter in particular, have extensive writing that we know about and the work that they've done in the narrative of the story. So Jesus having them close by, knowing even more intimate details along the way, is helpful so that they can help the rest of the group to understand and to use these things as they go. This is the same three, of course, that Jesus has taken on other occasions and will take just a little bit later from now when he goes into the garden to pray before he is actually arrested for the crucifixion. Now, all the disciples were traveling out of the city and they started going up the hill up Mount Olives and they came to the Garden of Gethsemane and Jesus took, as setting the disciples down, he took Peter, James, and John and went further. And then he had them rest in a certain place and he went on further to pray alone. But he kept Peter, James, and John a little bit closer. And just like in that account, when Jesus came back from the prayer each time, they were asleep. This was also done in this high mountain in Luke chapter 9 and the other accounts of the Transfiguration. It must have been done in the evening, or certainly they were just simply weary from the day. And while they were left alone for a few minutes to sit down, they went to sleep. And so that's the theme that I think we see among these three, is that they were tired. And I think it also implies very dearly that the account that we have is certainly not everything that Jesus did, and he must have kept them on the move quite a bit because they kind of stay tired. There's always a time to wanting to eat and take a break, and then of course they fall asleep every time they get to stop for very long. And I think that's an interesting observation about how the ministry went, that Jesus was very, very urgent about what he was doing, and he was maybe even busier than what we see a little bit as we read the individual accounts that are kept. So Jesus, when he's there, he is busy, and he is doing business as he normally does, praying. He's in the mountain. He's there, obviously, kind of quiet and alone since they've kind of fallen asleep, and he starts to pray, and maybe that even lulled them into a sleep along the way. But nonetheless, Jesus continues in that prayer. And while he is praying and in contact with the Father, he physically begins to change on this mountain. During the prayer, it says his body, his countenance, his physical appearance was altered and changed, even to the point that his clothes were affected. And his clothes became solid white and they were glistering. And that simply means that they were bright. They were bright and radiating light off of it. You know, Jesus was regularly in prayer and even more in these last few days. And it's not surprising that as he's in that strong and intimate conversation with the Father, that he begins to take on a transfigured state, even so that his clothing was changed. In Matthew chapter 28 and verse 3, look at that word with me if you will. Matthew chapter 28 and verse 3, after the resurrection, when they found the angel there at the gravesite, the angel was described in Matthew 28, 3 as his countenance was like lightning and his raiment white as snow. So this appearance of this angelic being is described very similarly to the way that Jesus is transfigured while he is here praying on the top of this mountain. I think it's clear to me, I'm very confident in this, that we are getting a glimpse of something spiritual. And it is not the first time that man has seen something spiritual. Moses, when he desired to see God, was not allowed to see God face to face. But you remember that he was put in the crevice of the rock and God covered him with his hand there. I don't know if he could see his hand or not. I always wondered about that. But he covered him up so that he couldn't see what was out as God passed by. And then it was uncovered briefly so that he could see the hinder part of God. Well, God, he actually saw that spiritual being that is God. It was brief and it was just a portion, but it was enough to see how real God was. This maybe out-of-body voice that he almost always heard, and it was pictured in something like a burning bush or whatever. He was asked, "Can I see you?" "Well, no, you can't look on me face to face, but I'll show you this." And it became real and maybe to Moses felt more tangible, although he saw the spiritual being that it was the Father. Elijah, of course, sees the evidence of God when he's in the mountain. And then he began to realize and know who God was in a very direct way and had those experiences that made him very real. In John, John in the book of Revelation talks about his view of Jesus when he was allowed to actually look into heaven. He looked into the spiritual realm. And if you turn with me to Revelation 1, when he describes Jesus, it's very similar to what we see here at the Transfiguration. Revelation 1, verses 12 through 16. "And I turned to see the voice that spake with me, and being turned, I saw seven golden candlesticks. And in the midst of the seven candlesticks, one like unto the Son of Man." Well, he certainly would have known who that was. He spent 3.5 years with him on earth, and he's been preaching and teaching about him all of his life since then. But he said, "I saw one like the Son of Man, clothed with a garment down to his foot, and girt about the paps with a golden girdle. His head and his hairs were white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes were as a flame of fire. And his feet like unto fine brass, as it were burned in a furnace, and his voice as the sound of many waters. And he had in his right hand seven stars, and out of his mouth went a sharp two-edged sword, and his countenance was as the sun shineth in his strength." So obviously a lot more detail as we see Jesus in the heavenly realm and John's looking at him, but there are a lot of similarities to the way it's described here at the Transfiguration of what these men were able to see and what happened to Jesus even before they were awake to see it. So again, Jesus is in prayer and this Transfiguration takes place. Also, while he is praying, Moses and Elijah appear to him. Now, Moses and Elijah have been gone from the earth for a long time. They are not in bodily form. They're not human back on earth. They were not resurrected from the dead because they weren't dead anymore. They were alive and they're living with God. And they appeared to Jesus recognizable, but it seems in spiritual form. As a matter of fact, Luke explains it that way in verse 31 that Moses and Elijah came in, verse 31, who appeared in glory and spake of his decease which he should accomplish in Jerusalem. So as Jesus was being transfigured into this other form, this other countenance, that different look and appearance, Moses and Elijah come and they look very similar. And they, of course, have come directly from the spiritual realm to speak with Jesus at this time on the mountain as he's praying. You know, Moses comes in, it would seem, as the epitome of the law of God from the past. Even the Jews of the day referred to it as the law of Moses. It really was the law of God that was delivered by Moses, but God had set it up so that Moses would be the face and the mouthpiece and the spokesperson for God on earth. God spoke to them in Exodus chapter 20, and he gave them the law, specifically the Ten Commandments that we talk about and know very well.
But all of the details of the law were then rendered to Moses, and Moses passed them on to the people. And the people even begged God, "You don't speak to us directly, let Moses speak to us." And they began to call it, of course, the law of Moses, meaning the law that Moses brought down from the mountain, from God. So Moses is considered the lawgiver among the people. Everything about their society, civilly, religiously, personally, publicly, everything that they do is guided by their law that came from God. And Moses is the one who delivered it, brought it to them, explained it to them, and reinforced that the generations after him would keep that through the design that God had given for leadership, spiritual leadership among the people. You'll remember that when Moses came down after 40 days of being on the mountain, Mount Sinai, there getting that law, remember his appearance looked different too. His face shone when he came down to the point that it was disturbing to other people around him. He wore a veil over his face that hid some of the shining. That seems to have dissipated over time because he didn't seem to wear that the rest of his life. But for a while after he came back down, the radiance that was being in the presence of God actually came on to Moses, and he ended up shining himself. And they thought it was odd and off-putting enough that they wanted him to cover his face so he could walk among them more normally. I guess he was wearing a mask, wasn't he? We've gotten kind of used to that idea, haven't we? And of course, Elijah being there, Elijah connotes to them the prophecy of the Old Testament and the judgment that came through that prophecy. Elijah prophesied during the days of the kingdom of Israel near the end, particularly the days of Ahab. Well, that's kind of the middle, really. But through the days of Ahab and on down there a little bit after that, he prophesied to really a wicked nation, never more wicked than it was under Ahab, although they became corrupt enough that they ended up falling away and being taken away into captivity sometime later. Elijah, of course, is the one you'll note in the way of judgment, called on the rain to stop, and it did not rain for 3.5 years. 3.5 years in a place that it normally did rain. And then he was able to call for that rain, and God released it on his word at that time. The spirit of Elijah.